to KVOO 89.5 San Francisco. Up next, Reality Sandwich. You're listening to KPOO 89.5 at San Francisco. I'm your host, Dr. Ray Farrick-Biggs. This is Reality Sandwich, which every week we explore different themes around consciousness, change, and transformation. Our guest today is Corey Silverberg. Corey is a certified sexual educator, author, consultant, and founding member of Come As You Are Cooperative. He received his Master's of Education from the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education. He's currently the Chair for Sexuality Educator Certification for the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. And he teaches on the topics including sex and technology, sexual pleasure, and sex and disability across North America. Corey can be found online at sexuality.about.com, where he writes and blogs about sexual politics, education, culture, and health. Hello, Corey. Are you there?
Whoops. Corey, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Great. I also want to mention, I'm also joined in the studio with Martin Matthews.
Hey there, Corey.
Hi, Martin. How are you?
I'm a Reality Sandwich co-host along with Rafe here, so I'll be engineering for him today and joining you guys on the show.
Great.
Great. Also, Martin, I know you had a brief announcement you want to make from last week.
Well, if Corey could indulge me for just one quick minute, because we'll cover this more on next week's show, but I wanted to follow up because I spoke about this briefly the last couple of weeks on Reality Sandwich regarding an assembly bill that was being put forth here in California that really was potentially infringing on our health freedoms, particularly in the area of health, of food and nutrition. Legislation, and I just want to announce that I went to Sacramento again this week, and myself, along with a number of other groups here in California, plus the mobilization of health freedom organizations throughout the country, we have succeeded in putting a stop to this bill for now. We've caused them so much uproar, so much data feedback and challenges regarding its wording and its implications that they've had to pull it from the agenda for this year. And at the earliest next year, it may come up. But the interesting news is this is, I think, a big win for people speaking out. And we're influencing the legislative process, and they're listening to us. So for right now, no impedance on our ability to choose who we want to consult with for diet and nutrition information here in California. So I'm pleased to announce that. All right. So with that, let me get back to you, Rafe, and our interesting show today with Corey.
Great. All right.
Thanks,
great,
Corey.
Martin.
Oh, no problem.
Good. Corey, why don't you share a little bit more about your background, how you became interested in doing your work?
Sure. Well, there's a long story and a short story, so I'll You just cut me off when it gets to be too long.
Okay.
I mean, my own background, so I actually grew up, my father was a sex therapist. He was an MD sex therapist, so he was a medical doctor who then became a sex therapist. And my mom was a librarian, but then went on to run consciousness-raising groups and do run some sexuality groups for women in the 70s. And so it was always part of my awareness. I mean, in some ways, my upbringing probably wasn't that different from a lot of others and people, and then in other ways, it was probably quite different. But working in and around sex was always something that was clearly an option. It wasn't seen as weird or bad or negative. And in fact, when I was 17, I guess I was 17, my father helped me through a connection and got me my first job at a sex store. And it was just the best job I'd ever had. And I really loved it. And so I ended up working there through school, working there for my undergraduate, and then I did a master's degree, I could kind of go on, but but it always, for me, sexuality has always been sort of just the most interesting, for me, the most interesting lens through which to kind of think about the world, right? So there's there's all sorts of ways of being with people and working with people, and sex has always kind of been my favorite. And then actually the store that I worked at, where I first got my first job, they had an interest in disability. So actually one of the women who owned it, her partner, had lived experience of disability. And so it was just kind of known as being, you know, something. It wasn't actually that accessible or anything, but it was known as being a kind of a safe place. So we ended up having a lot more customers that were out about being disabled, and that's kind of how I first got involved, sort of first kind of got connected to the disability community, which is now kind of a big part of my own life, although I'm currently non-disabled.
Right. Well, that was going to be one of my questions, is how you became interested in sex and disability, so that explains that. And as you know, I'm a disabled man from a spinal cord injury, and sexuality has been always a big part of my life, and that was really one of the questions I asked myself after my injury was, how can I ever enjoy pleasurable sex again? So I'd be kind of curious, for someone else who's newly disabled and who's kind of frustrated with, is feeling frustrated with his or her sexuality, what advice would you have for them?
Right. Well, I mean, it's hard, obviously, to give kind of individual advice.
Sure, right, right.
You know, we're all on a kind of a unique journey. I mean, part of, you know, so, I mean, first I should just say that, like, I appreciate how you're wording this, like, we should just be aware of how different the experience is for someone who may have grown up with a disability versus someone who acquires one later in life. And the big difference being around how other people treat you, right? So if you grew up non-disabled, you probably get access to some sex education, depending on where you live. It might not be much, and it might not be very good. But, you know, if you're a kid and you look non-disabled, and I'm using that kind of wording, very consciously, if you look like you're non-disabled, the world will kind of treat you like you're probably a little bit sexual, right?
Right.
You'll get messages, positive or negative, about, you know, being sexual with other people, about masturbation, about pregnancy, all these different things. If you grow up looking disabled, then you often don't get those messages. It's kind of assumed from parents and caregivers and friends that that's not part of your life. And so the struggle or the challenge to kind of construct a sexual self becomes very different. For someone in the situation that you gave, for someone who has recently acquired a disability, you know, I mean, the general kind of advice I have is to, number one, know that we are all sexual, and that means different things to different people. And for some people, that actually, that identity or that part of themselves means not being, you know, not having sex, and they don't actually feel a lot of strong sexual drive. Being sexual doesn't mean we want to have sex. It just means that in the same way that, you know, that not everyone will agree with this, but I'll say that we're all, you know, ethical and religious and spiritual and political, you know, animals as well. We are sexual animals, and so acquiring a disability doesn't take that part away. It will, though, probably mean that it changes, right? And certainly, you could speak to this very well,
right,
about how now you have your body works differently. In the same way, though, that you know your body works differently when you age, or if you get pregnant, or in lots of other ways. So part of it is about trying to remember, despite what everyone else is saying, that you are a sexual being, that you have sexual rights, that you are real, you know. I mean, for me, a lot of it actually isn't about the details of sex, and it's more about understanding how kind of messed up our world is when it comes to embodiment, right? That we have this idea that only certain bodies are good, right? It's only bodies that walk and that are thin and that are white and that are heterosexual. And those are the ones that get to have sex. And the rest of us, maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. That to me is the bigger obstacle. You know, we can talk more specifically, right? Like, I mean, the thing is, let me just say one other thing, and then, you know, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about it, but which is that in about 20 years of doing this, I've never met anyone who didn't I've never met someone who wanted to be sexual where they couldn't figure out a way to do it. Often what it needs, you need some support, you need some creativity, but we can all be sexual. We can all have sex. It'll just look different for everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, I found for myself after my injury and having a spinal cord injury, cervical injury, I had very little sensation or movement below my chest. So I couldn't really feel my genitals too much.
Right.
And I've described this recently on a, on the radio, but also recently on the Strange Sex show on TLC, is that I learned that other parts of my body that where I was more sensitive, including especially my hands, my thumb, felt really pleasurable when stroked in a sensual and a sexual way. And the more that area was stimulated, the more and more it felt more and more like my penis. And so I was able to start experiencing non-genital orgasms with enough practice. And I had the good fortune of studying Tantra, knew a little bit about energetic sex. So that has now become a whole new avenue for me to experience sexual pleasure. And trust me, I would have never figured that out, probably never figured that out before my injury. But with creativity, it's now possible.
Yeah. And this is actually, you know, when you talk to people who have had the opportunity and support to really explore their sexuality. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember that a lot of people who may be living in group homes or maybe living in isolated ways aren't going to have those same kind of privileges. But for those who do, what you just said is very common. I have lots of friends who say this, that basically their sex life is actually better. It's different, right? I mean, and this is the hard thing for people to get around because people think like, oh, well, good sex is, you know, a penis and a vagina and then, you know, a simultaneous orgasm. As a sex educator who's talked to thousands of people about their sex lives, I can tell you that that's actually not, doesn't really work for most people anyway.
Right.
So there is this idea that, like, people with disabilities should, what they deserve is sex that's as good as non-disabled sex. I tend to think that everyone should strive higher because when you work in sexuality, you find very quickly that there's lots of people who are not that satisfied with their sex life. So, I mean, so your experience is a very common one, I think.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, one of the challenges I run into, and I run a support group for sex and disability here in the Bay Area, it's a very common experience. It's just very challenging when you're single is find other partners to be sexual with. And so I think a big part of that stems, I know for myself, stems from, you know, maybe having low self-esteem about one's body image, maybe not being as confident, but also just I find it's more challenging because some people, and this may be true of people that even are not disabled, are going to find you attractive and other people will find you attractive. But for myself, I've definitely found it to be more challenging in meeting other people to be sexual with. And I'm just curious if you have any advice or have any insights into how to make it easier for people.
Right. Well, again, what you're saying is absolutely what one hears if one ever talks about this topic. There's a guy named Tom Shakespeare who's a disability activist who wrote a book called The Sexual Politics of Disability. And he often likes to say that the problem when you're disabled, and he himself is disabled, he says the problem when you're disabled is not how to have sex, it's who to have sex with.
Right.
And the first time I heard that was, for me, a total revelation. I mean, I have had partners that are disabled, sexual partners that are disabled. But again, because disability has been a part of my life for so long, the frame is different for me. And so my response to that in terms of, like, you know, tips and ideas, you know, the first thing is that when I started doing this work and I was sort of trained in kind of a rehabilitation model, what I would usually say is, well, you know, I would start with, like, you know, you got to figure out ways to get out there. So whether that's, you know, finding a hobby or joining a, you know, community group, or but just really getting out and meeting people is number one. Without hopefully having putting a lot of pressure on yourself that you have to find a sexual partner or a romantic partner. The first thing is just to find a community that is so hard when we live in isolation. And I would say that, and then I would say, you know, and then of course you got to get out there and have a positive attitude, and you know, you really got to put yourself out there. I've come to realize that there's a real problem with that attitude, particularly when it comes from someone like me who's non-disabled, which is that it really ignores what you're saying, which is that you're treated differently, right? We need to acknowledge this. And so that's the first thing I would say that we have to do is let's, like, stop kidding ourselves about the fact that if you smile enough or you join enough volunteer organizations, then everything's going to be fine. Because the fact is that if you use a wheelchair to get around, or if you're deaf or hard of hearing, or if you have other kinds of, if you communicate differently, people just judge you, right?
Totally.
And as you're saying, not everyone does. It's definitely important to know that there are absolutely, like, way more people out there in the world who will find you super hot and want to have sex with you than you would ever have time to have sex with. That is true of the globe. If you think about the global population, I promise it's always true.
It's just finding them.
It's finding them, right.
Right.
And so I do think there's a place for the kind of concrete things that we do have to push ourselves to do, like getting out there and doing things that feel good for you, right? So it's not about, like, joining, a book club if you hate to read. You need to find things that fit for you. And you need to know that there actually are lots of community groups and lots of organizations that are both inclusive of folks with disabilities and some of which are actually centered around people with disabilities. So, like, in Canada, disability hockey is a huge thing. I don't know if it's big in the States, but we like to play hockey, and there's lots of disabled hockey teams, for example. So I do think, you do need to get out there. You need to try to find people. But also it's important. But the thing is, it's hard. And I think that if we kind of set ourselves up to think that it's all on us, it's easy to kind of lose motivation. Once, you're going to experience rejection. And so having kind of a healthy dose of thinking about society as well and remembering, if I'm being rejected, like, there will be a personal element to that, but I'm also being rejected simply because of what I look like or who they think I am, and that isn't fair. And it's not that helps you find a partner, but that can help you deal with, the difficulty of living in a world where, ableism prevails, where what is the idea of beauty is this very normative body. So I think that I think what we all need to do is do a little bit of that. And then I would say, for people who it feels right, for naming that when you can, right? Naming ableism when you see it, that can be powerful. That can make you feel empowered. Certainly, I'll just say this one last thing is, the difficulty is that if you feel no power in your own body, if you do feel totally unattractive, if you feel like you have nothing to offer, then it becomes much more difficult to find a romantic or sexual partner because it's hard to connect with people when that's all you feel. At the same time, we need to be careful about saying, buck up and put a smile on your face, because I think that that's not really realistic either. I don't know. What do you think of that? Does that make sense to you?
No, it absolutely makes sense to me because there's been days where I feel very attractive. I feel very confident. I just feel good about myself. It's much easier to go out and meet people. It's much easier to go out and ask someone out on a date. And there are days when I just feel completely unattractive. I have no confidence, and it's just a challenge. And then that totally makes sense to me. And also this piece around, figuring out what it is that you enjoy doing. So one thing I really enjoy doing is dancing. And there's a great dance community in the Bay Area, and there's a lot of different events going on. So I just go to events, whether it's actual disabled dance or able-bodied, doesn't really matter. But just being in an environment where there's other people that are dancing, it makes me feel good. And I found that a great place to find dates.
Right.
So it works.
Great.
Yeah.
But I think it's great. I mean, what you're saying is, you need to, in addition, if the only focus is on finding a date, that can be really tricky. That to be able
absolutely.
To do, just enjoy, that'll make you feel good outside of, but I mean, something like dance is inherently, I think, also sexual or erotic.
Absolutely,
so
right.
It helps.
Very sensual.
That helps. That's your interest. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's a really good piece. But, the other thing that you mentioned earlier, too, is just this whole thing about, I would say, about our bodies and how, when my disability happened, my body changed quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a big issue that many people with disabilities struggle with is body image and how much that affects self-esteem. And I'm just looking to see for myself if there's anything that you've come across that would help people begin to shift the way that they view themselves, the way they look at their own bodies, the way that they might increase their self-esteem. Because I know when my self-esteem is high and I feel good about myself, it's much easier to meet people.
For sure.
Any thoughts or ideas there?
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, first I'll just sort of admit a bias, which is like that the sort of that I find sort of self-esteem and body image stuff, talking about it can be so vague because
sure.
I'm not really sure exactly what either of those things mean.
Right.
So, but to speak specifically about like what you're saying, I mean, you know, one of the things I'm aware of is that it's much more difficult to feel good about yourself, and I mean, I think the goal is for us each to create an image of ourselves, an idea of ourselves as sexy and as a body that we love some of the time. You know, none of us are going to love it all of the time. So that's kind of the goal. And I think that one of the things that's difficult to do that when you're visibly disabled is that you never see yourself anywhere as being sexy,
mm-hmm.
right? Like there's so, you know, when you look at magazines or newspapers or online, sexual imagery, erotic imagery, very rarely includes bodies that we would talk about as disabled bodies.
Totally.
Now, that doesn't mean that it isn't out there. And so the first thing I would say is go find some sexy images of people with disabilities. And you can find them online. One of my favorite – oh, am I going to blank on it now? I'm going to blank on it. There is a great photo series from Australia, Intimate Encounters. That's what it's called.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Have you seen that? Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And what this was is this is a photographer who basically collaborated with a bunch of different people with different disabilities and basically asked them, what's your sexual, like, what, you know, if you could paint a picture of yourself, you know, in your sexiest, most powerful image, what would that look like? And then they staged the photographs to look like that, and they're amazing.
Wow.
And there's a lot more. There's actually a local a photographer that's in the Bay Area whose name is David Steinberg.
Mm-hmm.
Who takes lots of erotic photographs of people having sex and has taken a number of that feature couples that are real life couples where I think either one or both people have a visible disability. And there's more. There's more and more people doing this every day, which is great about online. So one thing is to try to seek out stuff that can then inspire you. That's kind of sort of one piece of it. The other thing I think that we all need to do is learn more about our own bodies. And I think, you know, one of my frustrations, the reason that myself and Fran Odette and Miriam Kaufman wrote a book about sex and disability was because most of the sex manuals were just, there was so much ableism in it that they just didn't apply at all to a lot of people. And so our book is not perfect by any means, but it is kind of disability-centric. So, for example, you know, most sex manuals, it says, like, you want to learn about your body, you know, get naked, get in front of a mirror, and then, like, kneel down and look carefully and get a flashlight and do all these things that a lot of us can't do.
Right.
So in our book, basically what we propose, you know, we proposed a way, I mean, actually, I think I've written a version of this online on the sexuality.about.com website, which is basically a way of taking a tour of your own sexual body on your own. And it really is about using breath because we don't want to assume that everyone can touch themselves, right, because not everyone can. And learning about, you know, really taking the time to learn about, you know, how do you feel in your body, you know, where are there parts of your body that you can feel pleasure or that you feel good about or that you like the idea of? Are there other parts that you don't feel so good about? If there are parts where you feel a lot of pain, you know, are there other parts where you don't? Understanding that your body is completely unique to you, that no one can really tell you where it's going to feel good and where it isn't, and kind of learning, sort of, as I said, sort of taking a guided tour of your own body and finding where the good parts are, and then learning to kind of, you know, I'm going to use the word exploit them, but that's not the right word, but you know, if you discover, you know what, actually, I love the feeling of my hair as it hits the back of my neck. I really like that, particularly in the wind. Well, next time you're out in the wind and you feel that, can you just take a few minutes and really just sort of breathe and notice what that feels like? Why does it feel pleasurable? How does it feel pleasurable? Taking more time with that. Learning, you know, as you said, I mean, you had to discover, rediscovered parts of your body that could produce intense pleasure that you never would have noticed. And this is true for all of us. But we do need to, kind of tune into it. And so I think that there are some exercises there that we can all do that won't change things overnight, but that really kind of focus on our body as opposed to what our body's supposed to be, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. oh, well, my body doesn't have two breasts anymore, or my breasts don't look the way that the breasts in porn looks, or whatever it is, so I guess my breasts are useless, right? Which is a very understandable position for any of us to take, because we're inundated with this idea that, you know, that if you identify as a female person, then you should have these two great huge breasts that are super sensitive. So I think it's about kind of turning away a little bit from the mainstream understanding of what a sexy body is, and really checking in with ourselves.
Mm. I like that, because it's so true. Whatever we focus on expands, and if we focus on the things in our bodies that we don't like, that's going to get greater and greater. And you know, we focus on what does feel good and what we do find attractive, that's going to increase as well. So I think
I love that, this idea of what you just said, that whatever we focus on expands, and it's true. And we're told not to, right? We also have to remember that most of us are coming to this with having been raised, you know, told stuff like, you know, that our bodies are bad, or that, you know, sex is dirty, or that if any kind of sex is okay, it's really just the genital sex, right? That anything else is weird. So those are barriers that we need to at least acknowledge in ourselves in order to kind of be able to get into this other stuff.
Mm. I was, you know, on a whole another topic, I want to talk a little bit about masturbation. I saw you mention on your last newsletter that this is National Masturbation Month.
It is indeed. It is. I don't know what's happened to it exactly, because had you heard of that before?
I hadn't. No, that was first time.
Do you want to know a little bit of the history?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
So the story is that in 1995, a group of sex stores got together, kind of progressive feminist sex stores got together, and honestly, they were really, I mean, they were looking for kind of their hallmark holiday, right? So we know that, like, Mother's Day and Valentine's Day are not, they're really holidays that are meant to get people to buy things, and then maybe to increase awareness around something that's nice. And these sex stores were like, you know, sex deserves a holiday like this too. And so they decided to name May as National Masturbation Month, because masturbation is, without a doubt, the most frequently practiced sexual activity on the planet.
Absolutely.
And yet it's still one of these things that a lot of people are embarrassed to talk about. So and they started off, and at the time I was working at a sex store that was part of this, and so we all fundraised in order to give money to sex-positive organizations we liked. And the fundraiser was called the Masturbate-a-thon. And the way it would work was that you would go to people and you would say, on this particular day, I'm going to masturbate for as long as I possibly can. And I want you to pledge me for every 10 minutes, or I want you to pledge me per orgasm, or however you want to do it. And in fact, over the years, collectively, we raised tens of thousands of dollars this way. I think that most of the stores have, you know, that aren't really celebrating this anymore, but I still like to talk about it, because the fact is that even though I think for some people they would think, oh, masturbation, you know, everyone talks about that. When you work as a sex educator and you're getting people emailing you and coming up to you at workshops and asking you questions where they feel they can be honest, what you know is that for a lot of people it is still very shameful. That even though we can all joke about the movies that we see it happening in, there's a lot of people who just still feel a lot of shame about it, feel like they can't do it, are doing it and don't know if they can ever tell their partner about it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I wanted to, every May I still celebrate it. Because I think that I think we still need to talk about it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a very important topic, and it's the one thing that we all can be sexual, whether we're with our partner or not. It's something that we can enjoy, and it's a way that we can really discover our sexuality.
Yeah.
I have a young man I'm counseling right now, and he has a congenital disability, and so he grew up with this disability, has never been with a partner. And so we were just talking about masturbation, and it's one thing he's never really explored in great detail, mostly because we just mentioned about the shame.
Right.
And so we kind of explored what that was, and finally getting him to the place where he feels much more comfortable exploring. Now, one of the issues running into is because of his disability, he needs some assistance with just getting set up. And so, you know, he has to bring, you know, his attendants in. And so that's a whole conversation. Then, you know, we're exploring with his attendants and finding the ones that feel comfortable. So there's a little bit more that gets, you know, comes into the play, especially with any kind of disability. Even for myself, you know, I need attendants to help me with getting dressed and undressed. But I think it's important that we have these conversations with our attendants, with our family, with people around us, so that we can be more open about her sexuality and get her needs met.
Yeah, and also it's important because, I mean, it's so great that you're doing this, and right, and it's very lucky for him that he has you where you're right. going to have this conversation. I think a lot of therapists would be, well, I think you probably should just put that aside, right? I mean, it's very common for people to tell someone with a disability that they have more important things to worry about. You're obviously comfortable with this. I think that the other thing that's so great about it is not that you need to be in a position to be educating the world, because that is not your responsibility, but the more people talk about this, the more it just becomes obvious, right? So I'm involved in a research project right now that's about sexuality and attendant care, support work, and specifically about how to have these kinds of conversations. And whenever I talk to folks, both folks who are non-disabled, but also people who are disabled but don't use attendant services, and I say, I say a simple line, if you need help getting dressed, if you need help eating, going to the bathroom, you're going to need some support around your sexual expression. And you can see, for people who are open to it, a light bulb just goes off, and they're like, oh, right, I never thought about that. And so what you're doing, both by talking about it on the radio, but by being willing to talk with the person you're supporting about it, and also bring in attendance, it's a very important kind of consciousness-raising piece, right? Because I do think ultimately most people are willing to give everyone, to acknowledge another sexual rights. Most people are willing to do that. And it's just ignorance, right? It's just that they don't think about it. It's not part of their life. And so they take for granted that, like, oh, if you want to masturbate, you just go into a room and you masturbate.
Right.
Whereas if you have, there's another person whose work I just love. Her name is Laurie Erickson. Mm-hmm. And she has, I think she has a website, which I think is called FemGimp, I think is what it's called. She is doing a PhD, and she writes and talks a lot about sexuality. She talks about herself as, she uses this term, that she has an out body, which she says means like that people know about what's going on in her body because she needs help, when she's going to the bathroom, when she's menstruating, people know about that stuff when she's cranky. But how she's learned how when the people who support her, who she calls care shifters, when the two of them are working together, they also have an out body, and that, in fact, non-disabled people can benefit a lot from learning about these experiences. Because if you have to, if part of your masturbation includes negotiating with someone else, honestly, that kind of just, as you're saying, that makes, you have to focus more attention on it, and it gets bigger. And in our society, because we think of sex as being something that has to be so private and shameful, most people then think, like, oh, that would be horrible. And, of course, it's very challenging to have to. I mean, it would be nice for everyone to have access to the privacy they wanted. But the guy that we're talking about, for you to be able to learn to masturbate, and get pleasure from it in a way that also has to include negotiating and talking with someone else, that's actually pretty, it's pretty powerful. It's pretty profound.
Yeah.
There's a kind of sexual wisdom, I think, that comes with that, that we could all benefit from. And it's an interesting reframing, right, as opposed to thinking, that it's all bad and that it's all
right.
a drag. Even though, yes, the fact is that it can be quite a drag. But there's always ways.
Well, it's just about giving, people more power. And that's
right.
the one thing that I'm just trying to find out ways to empower this young man to be more sexually self-expressed. And so we're just, trying to figure out ways that he can do that. And the one thing he does have control over right now is his ability to masturbate and just figuring out ways that he can be more creative and getting more support. So
right.
that's one thing. The other thing that we've been exploring is the possibility of him working with a surrogate.
Sure.
And I'd love for you to share a little bit with the listeners, a little bit about sexual surrogates and maybe your view on how that might be used for people with disabilities.
Sure. So we'll start with some just definitions.
Yes.
So sexual surrogacy, I'll give you what my definitions are, and then if this doesn't fit with yours, then we can share them and come to a middle ground. But so when I think of sexual surrogates, what I'm thinking of is people who have received training to work with individuals with the goal of sort of expanding their sexual health, their sexual potential. Surrogates most often will actually work with a sex therapist in conjunction, so someone will be coming to a therapist, which is talk therapy, to talk about a sexual problem, inability to orgasm, or just, shyness around, never having had sex and shyness around being with a partner that first time. And so sometimes the therapy will just include talking. and then sending the person home to do homework on their own. Other times it might include a surrogate, which is basically, you know, to use this term, kind of hands-on work, where mm-hmm. a surrogate will work with you and your body in the room. They may get naked, they may touch you, they may not, they may touch themselves, they may have you touch them. It's always different,
mm-hmm.
but it often incorporates some kind of, it incorporates sort of using our bodies for this kind of work. It was kind of popular. I mean, I think it was much more frequently practiced in the 70s. There are still some sexual surrogates. In Canada, I have to say, where I live, there are very few. But I know that there's more in the States, and I think particularly in California. And so I distinguish sexual surrogates from sex workers, people who are doing different kinds of sex work, which is, you know, an umbrella term that sometimes people call people prostitutes or other things. I use the term sex workers. A sex worker would be someone who, you know, again, a surrogate, obviously, I should have mentioned, you pay a surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
Sex worker, same thing. You would pay a sex worker to engage in a kind of sexual interaction with you. Now, a sex worker, the reason I'm distinguishing those is that sex workers may or may not have other kinds of training, right? Some sex workers do and some sex workers don't. Whereas a surrogate, usually they have actually engaged in a course of training that may be, you know, a year or more. So that's sort of the distinction for me. You know, I guess my bottom line on all this is around access. So the thing is, I think if like a non-disabled person has access to a sexual surrogate or a sex worker, then someone with a disability should have access, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of that. You know, I know people who have a really hard time with the idea. The people whose response, I mean, I'm talking about people who live with disabilities, whose response is, you know, I don't want that. I'm already surrounded by people who are quote unquote helping me, by mm-hmm. service workers, and I find it a bit offensive to have someone say that in this area I should do that too. And I want to respect that position, that opinion. At the same time, I certainly have a lot of friends who are disabled who see sex workers and are very happy to see sex workers. That's part of their sex life, and they think it's a good part of their life. So, you know, again, I want to support that. And I think the attitude is true for non-disabled people too, right? Some people obviously think that. I think some people think sexual surrogacy is a sham, like it's not real. It's just kind mm-hmm. of a scam. And certainly some people think sex work is fundamentally wrong or oppressive. So we have a lot of different opinions. And because my position as a sex educator, the way I position myself is that it's not my place to kind of make a judgment about these things, that I want to be able to work with any individual, and so I'm going to work with them where they're at. What I can say is that I certainly know people for whom both of these have been helpful, right? That working with a sexual surrogate has allowed them to explore their body in a way that then helped them move that into a relationship with other people, right? That they you know, I can think of someone who really is not able to physically stimulate themselves at all and had never been with another person,
mm-hmm.
and the idea of being with a sexual partner was so scary and so unknown that they wanted this kind of middle step, and that they saw a sex worker and they found that really helpful. So I think that there's value there. I think that people who are interested in that should think about that. You know, I think that it's just about boundaries. It's just about being clear about what these relationships are. That when we're paying people to be sexual with us, that is different than when we're being sexual in a relationship that has no payment involved.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can I ask you what you think of it and what your do you know surrogates and do you, I mean, I'd be interested to hear your experiences with this stuff.
Well, yeah. So my experience, let me say, first of all, I think it's great because it's an option and it's a resource for people. So it really can empower people. And, you know, it may not be for everyone. In fact, it's probably not for everyone, but it is a resource. And from my own experience, I've not worked with a surrogate. I do have friends that are sex workers mm-hmm. and friends that are sex educators. And that actually do provide sex education. They are probably not may be legally called a sex surrogate. I don't know if they've been through that training, but they have had quite a bit of training, and I have worked with them. And it's been quite empowering for me because it's allowed me to learn different things about my body that I didn't realize. And it's also given me the feedback that, you know, what are the things they have found attractive about me. So it's it has actually expanded my own self-esteem. It's been a good bridge for me and being able to be more confident in my sexuality and learn more about what turns me on. So when I'm with someone, you know, that I'm being with in a romantic sense, there is a lot more possibility there. So it's been a very, very positive experience. And I'm interested in learning more, a little bit more about surrogacy and how they work with the therapist and, you know, being able to provide that for clients as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should say one thing we should acknowledge, and you probably know this, is that most surrogates and most sex workers don't actually know that much about disability. So it's not like sex surrogates. I mean, depending on the program, maybe they're going to get a little bit of information, a little bit of training.
Mm-hmm.
But we should know that in general, that still, unfortunately, like that kind of the ignorance around disability, that exists among those workers. And the same is true for sex therapists, right? Like, I know where I live, most sex therapist offices aren't even accessible, and most sex therapists don't get a lot of education around disability. For folks, if anyone's listening and is thinking, oh, maybe I'm going to try this, just be aware of that you and I are talking about this as if they're all great and comfortable with it, and certainly the professional ones should be open to it. They shouldn't have an issue with the disability, but it's not like they actually necessarily have a lot of experience or know very much about, you know, disability.
Right. Well, on that particular topic, I'm curious. I know last week was the ASEC conference down in San Diego.
Right.
Yes. And I assume that you were there.
I was.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm kind of curious about that conference. I haven't attended it yet. But how much education are they providing for sex educators and counselors and therapists around disability?
So it changes every year. I mean, the conference is like any other conference. So it's just made up of, there's plenary speeches and then there's workshops. We have the ASECT, which again stands for the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists. We actually have a sex and disability special interest group. So these are all professionals who work in and around sexuality and disability. And it's a wonderful group. And there's probably about 80 of us. And we mostly only communicate online because we're all across the world. But we do try to get as many people as possible to submit proposals. And usually there are, there will be between, I'd say, one and three workshops that are specifically around disability.
Mm.
This year we actually had a plenary talk on disability, which was really great.
Awesome.
So that means everyone was in the room for it. But it really ranges. I mean, I have to say, it's really hard. It's hard to find a place where you could go and get a lot of training with a disability lens. I mean, I'm hesitating because I realize I'm not even sure that it makes sense. You know, sometimes it makes sense to talk about sex and disability. I think what it makes more sense to me is to talk about sexuality in a way that is accessible and in a way that names ableism, right? Mm-hmm. That honestly, I always feel like even when we wrote this book about sex and disability, so it's me and two other authors, and one of the authors is disabled and the other author lives with a chronic illness. And so we had a lot of discussions about this because part of us was like, you know, when we write this book, we're segregating, right? We're saying this is the disability book. And while there are obviously important differences when you live with a disability, it is equally important to make connections about the ways that sexuality kind of our shared experience of sexuality,
mm-hmm.
and not mistaking the fact that what is most important, between you and I, the biggest difference is that you're disabled. That is not the biggest sexual difference between you and I. I mean, we don't know each other that well,
mm-hmm.
but I guarantee you, if we spent 3 or 4 hours together talking about sex, we would discover that your identity as being disabled or your impairment or however you feel about it probably isn't the biggest difference.
Right.
So it is such a challenge, right? For, you're a professional and you want to find places where you can learn more and share your experience. And it's great that you're doing, I know you do a series, and I think it's in Berkeley, is it? At the Center for Independent Living, yeah. And I think that in some ways, when I just always encourage other people to do what they can and then find, colleagues when you can and make learning opportunities where possible. ASECT is one place, and as I said, you know, you usually have a few workshops, but it's, you know, it's 3 or 4 days, and the majority of the information is not about disability, and honestly, the majority of the information still reflects a lot of ableism, right? So you're going to go into a workshop, and you're going to hear a talk that doesn't really acknowledge, you know, the different ways that our bodies work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's great that those conversations are happening, and I'm just kind of curious about what is happening in ASEC, and I plan to go next year. So, just to create more conversations where disability has that lens, like you said, and people are able to see that, you know, we do live in a world that is very ableist, and there are ways that just to make things more universally accessible for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
So at the ASEC conference, one of the things during the plenary that came up was that someone proposed that we really need to be thinking of is universal design sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone else said, well, I don't really like that idea because that makes it feels like it's it's making it generic, that they don't like this idea that universal design somehow means it fits everyone. I don't know. And you just used the term kind of universal design. So I'm curious, like, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, when I think of universal design, first of all, I haven't really thought about it in a sexual term. I've thought about it more in a, you go into a room or a building, and there it's designed for everyone to be able to get around and you have access to. So when it comes to sex, you're right. I mean, every individual is different, but being able to create environments where that is part of the conversation, I guess, that comes up. And people are more aware of that we all live with different kinds of, you know, 20% of Americans, and I would imagine Canadians, do live with some form of a disability or chronic illness. Yeah. So it's a large percentage of us, and not everyone is necessarily out about it or it's visible. So just creating more of a conversation that this is part of our lives and that people are aware of it, and it does shape. Like, I have so many friends that have met me since my injury or met me after my injury that are just much more aware of disability because they've encountered someone and got to know them. Where, you know, for myself included, before my disability, I really didn't know that many people intimately with a disability. So it was never part of my consciousness. So,
right.
Yeah.
And that's so important because people don't get that, right? People will look at you and identify you as someone who's disabled and then assume that, first of all, you've always been disabled, and also that disability is just a natural thing for you, right? And I just really appreciate that you said that, this thing about, like, that before you acquired a disability, you didn't know that many disabled people, so it was new for you. I think non-disabled people forget that all the time, right?
Yeah.
I think that they just forget that.
All right, I haven't spoken all show, but I'll say yes, that's true. this is Martin here. I can't speak on behalf of everyone, but it is not something that is in our normal consciousness to perceive. And if you were to, you know, pry or ask, probably in our subconscious or unconscious is the incorrect thought that, well, I guess that's just not on the table for them anymore. You know, kind of like how we think about old people. We just assume they don't have sex anymore, you know, after a certain point, which is entirely untrue. And I, as as a layperson and as a friend and colleague of Rafe's for many years, have been enlightened tremendously on this subject, and I'm absolutely fascinated by the work he's doing, and spreading the realization that God, pleasure is something that should be available and practiced by all human beings, and the pursuit of it is, I mean, we don't even have to talk about, gee, is that a right? It's just inherently human. And to explore this arena where folks have experienced, for whatever reason, an inhibition in that, you know, pleasure experience, to be able to explore and perceive and ponder, you know, how can we bring that into our lives, is, I think, tremendously valuable to the planet. Because the more that humans are feeling good in their minds and their bodies about themselves, the better we are as a species. So
I'd have to agree.
Pleasure creates more pleasure, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
True, true.
Awesome.
I mean, I'm interested, I don't know if you want to tell me if you don't want me to ask another question, but you talk about consciousness, and so it raises for me this question about, like, because you said it's not part of normal consciousness, and of course, you know, I always sort of, like, a flag goes up when I hear that word, normal. And so, you know, because part of me wonders, well, so then where does that consciousness come from, right? Like, when I think of consciousness, part of me thinks of something that's not just socially created. And certainly it's my belief that ableism is something that comes from society. Like, none of us are born mm-hmm. with this idea that there are good bodies and bad bodies. We just don't. It's not in our minds. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think about that, for me, when you were talking, to think about that this idea of consciousness and where our awareness of disability comes in. Is it something that we learn? Is it something that we're born with? I don't know.
Yeah, I think conscious. I mean, when I think about disability, it's really an awareness of whether we are aware of disability and how it exists. Like, I'll just speak for myself. Before my injury, I was never encountered too many people with a disability, so I never got to really see that world. And I mean, I had one friend in college who had a spinal cord injury. I didn't know him that well, but he was my first person that I started to really begin to see a little bit about disability. But it wasn't until my own injury that all of a sudden it was, you know, a big part of my world. So for a lot of people, that's, I think, how consciousness begins to expand, as we have an experience, whether it's through another individual or our own experience, that experience has our consciousness expand in a certain way. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. that's I'll just speak about that's from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Good. Well, we have a few more minutes left. I'm just kind of curious if there's anything else. I'm just kind of curious, what has been one of the most interesting or bizarre questions on sex that you've been asked?
Well, let's see. Oh, I don't know. I mean, I get asked a lot of questions about sex.
I'm sure.
It's hard to... Yeah,
that's a tough one.
I can't really answer that. I can't answer the bizarre, because the thing is that when you spend all of your time, like when sex is the only thing you do,
right?
Those kinds of boundaries around bizarre just sort of disappear. You know, I mean, I can tell you like commonly speaking of body things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, certainly the questions I most frequently asked are about bodies, right? So. I think about in my role as a guide at sexuality, like about.com, and so where I get a lot of emails, and most of them, I have to say, or the most common questions are, you know, about penis size, right? So mm-hmm. people who are very, very concerned that their penis is too small and that they're not going to be able to please a partner. Increasingly, unfortunately, I'm getting the same kind of question from people with women's bodies about labia. So I think my labia is too big, or, you know, or too long, or too one thing, which I think is very much the result of a lot of propaganda by cosmetic surgeons. But anyway, you know, so though, like this idea that, I mean, this is certainly the most kind of common question that I get, which is this idea that I think my body isn't going to work for sex. And you, Rafe, you mentioned masturbation, and certainly that's often where I'll go, which is to say, like, well, can you feel pleasure in your own body?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just sort of set aside the partner for a while. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, over the years, you just get, I mean, like, I've been asked about every fetish imaginable, and I'm often asked about fetishes that I didn't know about before. But again, once you get the questions about the lint fetishes and, I don't know, you know, fetishes for nose penetration and things like that, then nothing feels weird anymore. It's, you know, it's all about someone has a desire for something, and, you know, and usually, unfortunately, it's about that plus some shame, right? So people mm-hmm. don't know how to access either information or pleasure because they feel ashamed of it. And honestly, a lot of what you do as a sex educator is to give people context, right? It's to let them know, you know, because they haven't talked to 10,000 people about sex. But because I have talked to more than that about sex in, like, the past 20 years, it's easy for me to say, like, you know what, I've had that question before. And I can say that. Very rarely do I ever get a question at this point in my career that I haven't had before. And even if it's sort of worded differently, the concerns underneath them are often the same. So, yeah, I mean, I love my work, and I find it exciting all the time, but I don't find it, to be honest, the work itself isn't very titillating or very, that's what sex is for. That's not what my work is for.
It's got to be very satisfying, though. Hey, Corey, we just have about a minute left. Why don't we let the listeners know how to get in touch with you if they have any more questions?
Sure. Yeah, so the easiest place to find me online is this about.com website. So it's just, there's no www. It's just sexuality.about.com. And there they can find, you know, hundreds of my articles, and they can email me questions there. Also, if people want to contact me directly, I do have sort of my own website, which is just my name, Corey Silverberg, so C-O-R-Y, silverberg.com, and that has my work contact information. And those are the main places. I used to, as you mentioned, I was one of the founding members of a sex store called Come As You Are, but I left that store in June of last year. So it's still in the, it's still my favorite sex store, but that's not the place people can find me anymore. So now I work, you know, I just go out to, I'll go to hospitals and I'll go to public spaces and give talks. I sort of go where I'm, I go where I'm asked.
Fantastic. All right, Corey. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. And I just want to let the listeners know, if they want to get in touch with me, they can check me out at somaevolution.org, S-O-M-A-evolution.org. And Martin?
Folks can always find me at nourishinghope.com. And thanks again, Corey, for giving everyone a heads up about National Masturbation Month.
Right on.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right. Well, until next week, be well.
Inside, poverty still dead, still dead. Ain't no matter where them politicians are, say, yeah, yeah. Poverty still dead, still dead. I told them it feels like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. Yes, no matter where them politicians are, say, yeah, yeah. Poverty still dead, still dead.
Yeah. Circumstances made us who we are.
You know, let's live and learn.
Make my heart stop and stop.
Bless the youths, them who keep striving for happiness. Don't take no check, man, pull up a reflex. A two we up, one mobile, we no take one left. Now left me impressed. Hey, look how she full of happiness. Tell her she smile, cause she got it delicate. Long run started. Babylon, elites and press. Make a burnout with them fitness. Yeah, yeah. Feels like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. Ain't no matter where them politicians are, say, yeah, yeah. Poverty still dead, still dead. And today maybe it's like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. Ain't no matter where them politicians are, say, yeah, yeah. Poverty still dead, still dead. Still dead. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Keep your head up high.
Keep your head up high.
Sky's the limit, you know. Do something.
Up your gun, take off your book first. Now for them, them not mind, them look at them a big puff. Teeth like a puss and right, and now them in a tough luck. Say things rough, ah well.
Progress is the name of the game. It comes with fortune and fame. So when the money make, let it be joy your way.
Hey, they may feel like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. Ain't no matter where them politicians are. Poverty still dead, still dead. Yes, they may feel like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. Ain't no matter where them politicians are. Poverty still dead, still dead.
Circumstances made us who we are.
Bless the youth who keep striving for happiness. May pull up a reflex, we know this. I up while the mobile, them youths, and no take no what left. Now leave me impressed, she full of happiness. Hey, smile, black woman, because you got it delicate. A today may feel like settings right inside. Poverty still dead, still dead. All oh, the matter with them politics, and I say, yeah, yeah. Poverty still dead, still dead. Hey, they may feel like settings right inside. Poverty still dead. Still dead, ain't no matter with them politicians, I say, yes, poverty still dead.
KPOO San Francisco is listener supported.
If you like the program you're listening to, donate online. Visit KPOO.com and click on donations. It's easy, it's quick, and it's tax deductible. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Frank Williams, the program director for the Senior Ex-Offender Program.